Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of The Cutty Strange on Wavefarm's WGXC 90.7 FM in New York's Upper Hudson Valley. On this month's episode, we're going to explore the ideas behind reappropriating pop music. Last month, we ended with the track by Encephalus, Michael Jackson in Order, which took all of Michael Jackson's non-lyrical vocalizations, grunts, oohs, ahs, and everything, and organized them chronologically from start to finish according to when they were released on his discography. And I began to wonder more in the last month about other artists who've taken popular music and completely mashed it up. Not in the sense of sampling, where we're creating something out of a loop or parts of a song and mashing them together, but a whole track and making it something all in its own. And I think the most appropriate place to start would be John Oswald and Plunderphonics, which is a 1985 essay of the same name that discusses the ideas of taking existing digital media and creating a new art form or art piece out of it. The first one I like to do, leading off from Encephalus and his Michael Jackson track, is Dab by John Oswald, which takes Michael Jackson's Bad and reappropriates it as he sees fit. Here's John Oswald's Dab. Bang. And that was Dab by John Oswald, exploring the idea of plunderphonics, a term he coined in 1985 in his essay Plunderphonics, or Audio Piracy as a Compositional Prerogative. He defines plunderphonics as any music made by taking one or more existing audio recordings and altering them in some way to make a new composition. This is a very broad term and can be used to define sampling and DJ culture or basically any music concrete. However, we're looking at this on this episode and the music we're listening to as taking from popular music and reappropriating it into a new composition. And that takes us to the music of James Tenney, who in 1961 wrote his Collage No. 1, or Blue Suede, which is based on a recording of Elvis Presley's Blue Suede Shoes. And James Tenney took all of the techniques available to him at the time and fiercely manipulated this piece and this recording. And what makes it special is that it was popular. It was a popular music. It wasn't a sample of nature or trains or anything like that. It was something that people knew. And you don't know it's Elvis at first, and then as the piece progresses, his iconic voice starts to shine through. So here's James Tenney's Collage No. 1, Blue Suede, from 1961. And that was James Tenney's collage number one, Blue Suede, based on Elvis Presley's Blue Suede Shoes. And on this episode, we're talking about the reappropriation of pop music, and we jumped into Plunderphonics with John Oswald. And I want to jump back into Plunderphonics for a minute, because Oswald also has a piece based on an Elvis Presley tune called Don't. And this was released with three other tracks on an EP by Oswald and made some controversial waves in 1988 when it came out, which we'll talk about more after we listen to it. But here's John Oswald's Don't. And that was John Oswald's Don't. And the next thing I want to talk about is regarding the cultural and legal implications of reappropriating popular music. And I understand that the term reappropriation may seem a little extreme. However, in my experiences as a musician who is trained and also one who loves popular music, there is a lot of conflict and contention with, you know, people who are trying to argue what they consider high art versus low art, what art is more important versus what is less important. And I don't think that's a valid discussion anymore and one that should be had. I think a coexistence of popular music and artistic music or academic music, whatever you want to label it, are equally important and in many ways equally difficult to achieve and equally difficult to succeed at. Writing a song is not the same as writing a string quartet, but writing a song is no more easy or no more difficult than writing a string quartet, and vice versa. They just are different things. They exist in different worlds, but they need to meet and coexist in one world. And I don't think that happens enough and this is why I wanted to share this music, is that it goes both ways. And the next pieces we're going to listen to are by a composer named Bernard Parmigiani, a very famous French tape music composer who passed just a couple of years ago. And he wrote two pieces, one in 1968, the next in 69, that take samples or recordings of popular music at the time and blend them with recordings of classical music, early music, and sometimes modern music that had just been released by his peers or his colleagues. And he puts them together in this amazingly harmonious way that I feel demonstrates that these two worlds can coexist and do, and they're influenced by each other. And and I think a lot can be achieved and recognized if there's no conflict in the middle of it. And later we're going to see how it works the other way, how the pop music world is influenced by the artistic or academic music world. But first, we'll listen to these two pieces. The first is Pop Eclectic, written in 1968, and the second, Le Pop Doulant, written in 1969, both by Bernard Parmigiani. And I will put a short pause in between the two pieces.
des sons de provenance extrêmement divers.
Il faut quand même que je commence.
Essayez de poursuivre aujourd'hui.
Thank you. God, it's God, I say God.
There we just heard two pieces by Bernard Parmigiani, the first Pop Eclectic, written in 1968, and the second Le Pop Dulin, written in 1969. And those pieces, again, explore the idea of taking recordings of popular and classical music or avant-garde music, putting them together in one sphere and seeing how they coexist. And before I was saying the calling for the need for these art forms to coexist because, you know, I don't think people are quite battling each other over what's legit and what's not. However, I've experienced, again, playing in bands and also being a member of the academic music institutions, that there would be a weird mood around one another. A lot of musicians I know, great ones, they write songs and they compose music and they use all of their skills. I personally don't write songs. I do compose. I love pop music. I love playing in bands. Do I feel that my knowledge is more legit than an amazing songwriter? Absolutely not. Do I feel like a lot of people in the academy feel that way about what they're doing and that they're more legitimate than somebody who's writing popular music? Absolutely. And the other way around, people I've met who write songs often lay claim to the fact that it's accessible and people understand it. However, these are all influenced by each other. And without going more into it, I just wanted to demonstrate a clear and obvious example of this with the Beatles, and the Beatles bumping shoulders with very important luminaries of new music in New York during the 60s when they were active, and later. And the fact that Paul McCartney was a huge Karlheinz Stockhausen fan is no mystery. And I wanted to play a track that many people, I'm sure, know, but I think is a very important one, and one that is kind of polarizing among Beatles fans. But I think it's really important that they did this and released it. And, you know, maybe it's been a while since we've all listened to it. This is Revolution 9 by the Beatles.
A little carrot for you if I'd realized. I've forgotten all about it, George. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me?
Yes.
Cheeky bitch.
Number nine.
Standing still.
Upon the telegraph.
Number nine.
To his false is the headmaster he bore to tell what he
voice was low and his eyes high. Watusi. The twist.
Eldorado.
Take this, brother. May it serve you well.
Maybe it's not
what? What? Oh.
Maybe even then.
And there we had the Beatles' Revolution 9 off their Beatles' White album. And I wanted to play that to, again, demonstrate the crossover between popular and avant-garde music and how these things coexist with each other and the amazing results that are found when we just break it down and just accept everything. It could be a very powerful result. And I don't think it's fair to only play Revolution 9 because it is more of the experimental side of the Beatles, the most experimental side of the Beatles, that divided their fans still to this day about the quality and legitimacy of that track. So I want to end today's show with one more Beatles song from Revolver, Tomorrow Never Knows, because this was released in 1966 when Paul McCartney was especially into the tape music of Stockhausen and Varèz. And, you know, it's a beautifully crafted song in the production and the extra, we'll say, extra musical materials that are not within the standard pop structure or standard pop sound are what really make this song special. So to conclude, here's Tomorrow Never Knows by The Beatles. Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of The Cutty Strange on Wavefarm's WGXE 90.7 FM in New York's Upper Hudson Valley. Each month, we explore new ideas and sound in the world of transmission arts and the avant-garde. If you have any ideas, music, or topics you would like to share or propose to be aired on the show, you can write us at thecuttystrange@gmail.com. That's thecuttystrange@gmail.com. The Cutty Strange is produced and hosted by Daniel Steffi out of Brooklyn, New York, and airs on the first Thursday of each month at 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thank for tuning in.